FM Seattle. It is 8:30, and we have live in the studios with us this week, Ja Parrish, co-editor at Eat the State. Good morning.
Hi there.
Has there been a coup? Where's Maria?
I think Ashcroft. I think that's why he came to town was to oversee her detention. And she was deported back to her country of origin. And we've been trying to
figure
get
out
a hold of her.
Is.
Well, we've been trying to get a hold of her and raise her for the last several days. And we're worried. We are worried, but hopefully she'll be back in time to put an article into the new issue of Eat the State coming out this in a couple of days. So
you guys are cranking it out this weekend.
So. Yeah, we are. So she better.
Well, maybe she
better
went,
have access to email from
maybe
whatever
she just
country
went into
she's
hiding
in.
To work on her articles. For that.
or she just went into hiding because Ashcroft was in town.
Okay.
But yes, no, she's actually just a little bit under the weather, so she should be back next week.
Okay.
Assuming it wasn't like a biohazard or a terrorist attack or something.
Right.
So,
okay. Well, let's move along. We got tons to cover.
Oh, and by the way, I was actually at John Ashcroft's press conference on Tuesday and got to ask him a question. And I've been showering ever since then. So it was quite the experience seeing the man, the legend.
I'll bet. And now that you've brought that up, I have to ask you what question you asked him and what his response was.
He only actually took about 5 or 6 questions. This was on the little Coast Guard base down at Pier 36. So, it was like well out of eyesight or hearing from any of the protesters. You had to go through military checkpoints to get on, blah, blah, blah. And he only took about 5 or 6 questions. He just did the, basic stump speech of how much safer we are and how many people he'd locked up and thrown away the key for. And then took some really banal questions, and there were a couple of good ones. And I asked him about a follow-up to Patriot Act, if Patriot Act 2 was being prepared for submission to Congress, and if so, what was in it, and when was it going to be there? And he said, expansion of powers that weren't already in Patriot Act 1, well, that's something that we're discussing. And went on. He actually gave somewhat of an answer, talking about powers that police and law enforcement already have for the war on drugs, for example, of grand jury subpoena power. And we need that tool in the toolkit for the war on terror as well. And he didn't mention anything about the Constitution being in the toolkit or the Bill of Rights or civil liberties being part of the toolkit. And I have to say that the 15 or so people from local media who were there, with one exception, did a really lame job of asking him questions. Nobody asked anything about immigration or immigrants or non-citizens. Nobody asked any, all of the various things that have been controversial in Ashcroft's reign. And nobody asked anything. I mean, here's the nation's chief law enforcement officer who's strutting around at a military base, out in Seattle Harbor with a rear admiral, probably because Bush already did the flight suit gimmick. And nobody's asking him, the nation's chief law enforcement officer with 2 million-plus people in this country in prison, about any law enforcement matter other than terrorism or terrorists. And his little 9-minute stump speech, I counted 25 mentions of terrorist and 17 mentions of America. So it was basically a commercial for that. But he didn't ask us to pray, even though it was a little morning breakfast thing, and he didn't ask us to sing, which I was tremendously thankful for. So,
well, my understanding is when he does his morning gigs back at in D.C., he does, of course, both that, ask people to sing, and little pieces he wrote. So
yes, Soar
with
the Eagles.
I think he would have known ahead of time. He would have been passing out the words.
Well, it actually is available on the internet. Ashcroft has a very patriotic song which he has asked staffers to sing, and we probably should get onto the news of the week, but it's called Soar with the Eagles. It is one of the worst songs ever perpetrated upon the ears of a humankind that's seen some really bad music in the last millennia. And it is available on the internet if people want to go looking for it, if they really want to subject themselves to a treat.
Okay.
That was my week with Johnny.
All right. Well, let's move along. Speaking of national security risks, friend of both of ours, Jackie Hudson, she was back in Colorado this week.
Yes. Jackie is the Dominican nun who, along with two other nuns, Carol Gibbot from Michigan and another woman from Baltimore, Maryland, have committed a civil disobedience last fall, hammering on a plowshares action in northern Colorado, hammering on a Minuteman to missile silo, and received enormously heavy federal charges over it. And in the Denver area in Colorado, this has been a huge story. There's been a tremendous outpouring of public support for these three elderly nuns. One woman, I think Carol is in her is 56 or in her mid to late 50s, and the others are both over 65. And the feds were asking for, you know, enough years in jail time that they were all going to die in jail, you know, 20, 30 years in prison. They were found guilty about a month and a half ago, I believe, in a trial where they weren't really allowed to give much of the testimony that they wanted to give about international law and you know, the urgency of committing a crime to prevent a greater crime and a necessity defense and all those kind of things. And they have been out on bail since then and raising awareness and doing speaking for the gigs and interviews. And Jackie was back here for a little bit. And they had sentencing yesterday. And the federal prosecutors did not get the sentence that they wanted. The defense did not get the sentence of probation that they wanted. So the three women were sentenced for between 30 and 41 years in prison. That's basically...
No, months.
Months, I'm sorry. I meant to say months. So basically, I was at 30 to 41 months, meaning 2.5 to 3.5 years, basically. So, you know, with good time, you're talking 2 to 3 years in prison, which is... not nearly as bad as it could have been. Nonetheless, at the same time, I think a lot of people consider these women to be heroes. They're people who, in a time of when people are, many people are feeling very intimidated by the increasing police powers and increasing public support for militarism in this country, women who were willing to take enormous personal risk and take a stand to draw attention to the many, many weapons of mass destruction still on high alert in this country, and the enormous amount of money that's being poured into development of future generations of high-tech weapons of mass destruction in this country, and say that we as citizens have a responsibility to call attention to this and to do something about it. And you know, they've raised an enormous amount of public awareness for those issues and done a tremendous public service by taking on those risks. So they will be going to federal prison now. There is a local support group for Jackie. She lives in Bremerton in Kitsap County, working through the Ground Zero Center for Nonviolent Action. And for people who are interested in helping her out or writing to her, the Ground Zero website, I think, probably would be the best place to go. And do you remember that offhand, what the website is?
Yes, I do. It's gzcenter.org.
Right. So, and so people should get involved or write her a letter and just say thank you, because they've done a lot of good.
Yeah, Jackie ended up getting 30 months. Carol Gilbert got 33 months. And Ardith Platt was the
third
person that
remember.
41 months.
Yes. And those were because of the different records that they had. Jackie has one previous federal offense for a previous Minuteman a couple years ago in Colorado. And the others had also done Polishier's actions 3 or 4 times.
And we'll be airing, Jackie spoke a week ago here in Seattle, and we'll be airing that talk tomorrow morning. So people
Great.
Should
what time?
Tune in for that. You know, I'm not positive it'll either be at 6 or 7.
Okay.
We're still juggling the schedule.
Well, if you're not up then, for any listeners, set your VCRs and record it because she's a good speaker.
So. Or you can check in, you know, via our website. We do archive all our stuff here for 2 weeks.
And that website is?
www.kexp.org.
We are just cross-promoting like mad this morning.
We are. So. All right. Well, moving along, let's briefly... Last week we mentioned the FCC, there was a House vote coming up regarding the FCC.
Yeah, that we had mentioned last week that the House of Representatives and politicians in general had been challenging some aspects of the recent media ownership deregulation action that the FCC took. That, you know, there was an FCC hearing that one of the commissioners, Michael Copps, set up here in Seattle. And a tremendous amount of controversy and support from the media democracy movement for challenging the deregulation. That was pushed through by Michael Powell, the Bush appointee who now heads the FCC. And there's been a backlash against it in Congress. And that had moved through the House Appropriations Committee last week that we talked about, that it had gotten bipartisan support, that there was a pretty solid vote by members of both parties to strip one of the provisions from the deregulation regulation that the FCC put through, and that was the ability of large media conglomerates. Their current restriction is that they cannot own broadcast stations that reach more than 35% of U.S. households. That is, for their stations in New York and Chicago and L.A. and Philadelphia and Houston and Seattle and Atlanta and so forth, that it can't add up to more than what would that be, about 90 million people in the United States. Well, Powell wanted the FCC moved that up to 45%, and the House Appropriations Committee had voted last week to strip the funding from that so that and to repeal that so that it would still remain at 35. That was part of the appropriations bill that went through the entire House of Representatives this week, and the vote that that considered that passed by 400-21. It was a massive bipartisan show of support, and it wasn't just that this was tacked onto a bill that, that people would have opposed it if it had been by itself, but it was slipped through. That particular provision challenging the deregulation had broad bipartisan support. And I want to talk to that a little bit because people might have the impression that the idea of challenging these handful of companies, the five or six huge companies that own so many different media properties and so many different types of media in this country, that that's a progressive issue of challenging that those few large corporations. It's not. It is an issue that both Republicans and Democrats and independents and sort of non-political people in this country care a lot about. And you see the support among conservatives and in the right in particular because of the combination of companies owning both television production and video facilities as well as owning cable outlets and the broadcast properties and the networks. So what you have is, say, a network like NBC, and all of the networks are like this. They do more and more of their programs in-house. They produce them themselves, and that way they can sell the rights for syndication, for videos, for overseas sales, for all of these things, all of the vertical and horizontal integration and all of the things that corporations do right now. And what that means for middle America that is, for example, offended by sitcoms that are a half hour of sexual innuendos and laugh tracks, or, you know, gratuitous violence, or things or even, you know, homosexuality is depicted by Hollywood. All of these things that offend, say, conservative Christian sensibilities, that can be applied to the concern over media conglomerates also, because what you lose is local control over broadcasting. You lose your local radio station. You lose local newspaper editorializing. So you don't have the kind of community standards and community tastes that you would otherwise. That's important in a place like Seattle, but it's also important in Des Moines or Wichita. And so, you know, when people are considering the whole media democracy movement and the idea that media deregulation is going to be an uphill battle to try and stop, it's not. It has broad political support, and people should consider that these large companies, the Viacoms and Disneys and all of the others, that it's something most of America doesn't want to see, is having those handful of companies control all of our broadcast voices.
Yeah, but I think it's still going to be an uphill battle.
Well, simply because the money is all on that side. But
right.
It really is money versus the concerns of an awful lot of people.
Yeah, but that's true of just about everything we're talking about, you know.
Oh, not necessarily. For example, with issues like militarism and the weapons of mass destruction in this country, you know, there is a lot of support in some parts of the country for Bush's military adventurism overseas. I don't think you have as much, you know, automatic knee-jerk support for Viacom having more television stations.
Mm, yeah. Well, that's probably true. All right. Well, speaking of military adventures.
Overseas adventures, yeah.
Overseas adventures. The heavy-duty coverage this week of Saddam's sons being gunned down live. I mean, I think they're already sold off the movie rights on that one.
Yeah, they have. And they probably will have the made-for-TV movie soon that will show Jessica Lynch, you know, personally shooting both of those. And this, you know, will be based on actual events, and people will come away with the impression that that's actually what happened. And Jessica really is a hero. a number of interesting aspects of the death of Uday and Cusey that really haven't gotten a lot of attention in this country. First, of course, was the decision by the United States, which has upset an awful lot of people in Iraq. And in fact, I heard Robert Fisk talking about this on Democracy Now! Yesterday, that and this is true of upsetting a lot of people in Europe also, that a lot of people did not want to see the United States going in like gunslingers and just automatically killing these guys. And the same will be true of Saddam Hussein when he is eventually found, as he almost surely will be. Folks didn't want these guys killed. They wanted them captured and put on trial for their crimes against humanity, of which there were many. So that was one issue. The fact that the way the United States handled this denied a sense of justice to many Iraqis who were victimized by the Saddam Hussein regime, and also undermined the United States' claims to represent democracy, because what you have here instead basically is vigilante justice. You know, you're talking about four people armed with Kalashnikovs in a house, and you know, the 101st Airborne or whatever it was coming down against that house. You cannot possibly tell me it was impossible to get to these guys any other way. So that was one issue, the fact that that they could have been captured alive, they could have been put on trial, they could have been able to talk quite a bit about decisions internal to the Saddam Hussein government and what they did, and you know, when they did it, the governments and corporations that supported them over the years, which you know maybe is why the United States isn't anxious to have these folks alive. So that was one issue. The more interesting part of it, though, was the spin in this country instead, the whole notion that because these two are dead, therefore the bitter emners, the last few remnants that are now in what is called a guerrilla uprising, they can use the word guerrilla, but they haven't been able to use the word war yet, even though you know we've been doing This Week in Iraq features for the last month and a half talking about all of the, you know, the steady parade of daily attacks against U.S. and to a lesser extent British soldiers in Iraq, and how that really has taken on the characteristics of a guerrilla war that's being planned throughout the country, that is being very systematic in its attacking of infrastructure as well as attacking of U.S. convoys, that is resulting in casualties pretty much every day at this point. So you can have Cusey and Uday being killed on Tuesday, and you have George Bush coming out on Wednesday and saying, you know, well, there's still a last few, the remnants that are holding out, and we'll mop that up, and it'll all die out just as soon as Iraqis see, the vast majority of Iraqis understand the success that we've had in rebuilding Iraq. And of course, you know, he's saying this while the 5 million people in Baghdad still have spotty electricity after 3 months of American rule, and in many parts of the country, access to food and water is always a crisis waiting to happen, and you know, there's still no basic security in most of the country after 3 months. So there's been very little of a sense of that success among ordinary Iraqis. And at the same time, you had last week the very autocratic appointment, which we, you know, Maria and I talked about on this program, of the National Governing Council in Iraq, that almost all of the people on that council were either handpicked by the Americans or handpicked by the people who were handpicked by Americans. There is no sense whatsoever that the United States is bringing either democracy or stability to Iraq among ordinary Iraqis. And the sense isn't that, well, with Saddam's sons now gone, that the war will die out. The sense is actually pretty much the opposite at this point, that, you know, with the chance that Saddam Hussein's government will come back now being less than ever, the need for the Americans to be present is now less than ever, and it's time for the Americans to go. And the Americans are showing every sign of settling in and siphoning Iraq's resources away from it and denying Iraq's Iraqis the opportunity for self-determination for a long time to come. You have the dramatic gap between rhetoric and reality in Washington, D.C. right now, of some sort of expectation that this guerrilla warfare is going to go away. because Saddam's sons are now dead. It actually, I think, is more of a spur, and the appointment of the National Council is more of a spur. And incidents like the one on the day after his sons were killed, where not only were three American soldiers killed that day, which is what got all the headlines here, but two more Iraqis were killed at a checkpoint in Baghdad when they failed to stop in a timely manner. And so the U.S. military just opened fire on them. And this is the flip side of the very stressed and under-equipped U.S. military, which has not been trained for peacekeeping and policing duties, being asked to fill the role that they're being asked to fill. They're also firing on often unarmed Iraqis much of the time. It's a classic sort of guerrilla warfare situation where, again, as we've talked with about on this program, you couldn't have the attacks in broad daylight if the people who are taking up arms against the American soldiers did not have the support of the vast majority of the population that was willing to hide them when they engage in attacks in broad daylight. And therefore, for the soldiers, they have no idea who the enemy is among the population. They're jumpy, they're skittish, they're opening fire on people regularly. And every time you have these kind of atrocities, it's that many more people who hate the Americans and say it's time for them to go. It's a dynamic that's just going to continue to feed on itself.
So we have a situation there where the soldiers and the people of Iraq just want the soldiers to go home. And then, coincidentally, in Liberia, there's a big call, if you read the papers anyway, that they want
the Americans there. Yes. And, you know, again, we talked about this here, and I wrote about it a month ago, the situation in Liberia and the depredations of Charles Taylor, the former guerrilla leader and weapons dealer turned into a war criminal. There was a war crimes indictment handed down by the UN a couple months ago against Taylor. And because of the historic associations between Liberia and the United States, and the precedent that's been set in the neighboring countries of Sierra Leone and Côte d'Ivoire, I can never quite pronounce that because my French is awful, but those are the two neighboring countries, or the two main neighboring countries of Liberia and West Africa. They've also had major armed conflicts in the last year that were solved by the colonial powers respectively associated with those two countries, Britain and France, both sending in peacekeeping troops. Well, the United States being the country that historically has been associated with Liberia, Liberians have wanted the United States to send a peacekeeping force or to head a peacekeeping force there for some time, as this civil war, which has been going on for 10 years but has particularly heated up in recent months, has escalated, has gotten closer to the capital city of Monrovia. You had, even last month, 250,000 refugees in a country of only 2.5 million, a country whose population is approximately the population of King and Pierce County combined. I mean, we're not talking about a large country. The Seattle Police Department probably has more arms and a better supply of munitions than the armies in Liberia. But the United States Army is stretched so thin right now between the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, and then the other commitments that it has offered itself up for in places like the Philippines and Colombia and Indonesia and Georgia, Chechnya, and all the other various places where the military is involved right now. It just doesn't have the personnel. It doesn't have nearly the personnel to do what is needed to be done in Iraq, which people on Capitol Hill are finally starting to own up to. Again, something we've talked about for months on this program. And at this point, however, it's not just a question of military availability. Nigeria has been trying for the last week to send a peacekeeping force into Liberia. And they're running into a couple of problems. First is that because they have waited so long and it's taken so long, primarily because the Bush administration in Washington have been dithering so long, Nigeria has been unable to, and they're doing this on behalf of the UN, and other West African countries are also contributing troops. They've waited so long that the rebels, they're now into Monrovia, and the way they've come in is to cut off the port. They've cut off the main route into the capital capital city from the port, so that if a peacekeeping force comes into the country right now, it's going to have to fight its way into the country, which it makes the task exponentially more difficult. But above and beyond that, Nigeria does not have the money to send the troops in, and we're talking, you know, $10 million. It's not a lot of money by Washington standards, and the Bush administration again had made a commitment to help out with this and has, you know, in terms of rhetoric, but has not actually ponied up the money. So as the casualties mount, and we're talking about hundreds of people dying every day in a country where the hospitals are already flooded to overcapacity, and there's a tremendous humanitarian crisis brewing also, because all of the hundreds of thousands of refugees, very questionable whether they have access to food and water, let alone medical care, in the middle of a war zone, that, you know, every day that the Bush administration dithers and talks about, you know, well, maybe we'll send some troops and in a week or so they'll be off the coast of Africa, every day people are dying, and even neighboring countries that want to do something about it and could move much more quickly have been unable to so far, because of Washington's recalcitrance. And this again reflects to Muslims and to people in Africa about the United States' lack of commitment to human rights and to its own international responsibilities when it does not have something that it can directly gain out of it, a la oil or geopolitical influence.
All right, just a couple minutes left. North Korea continues to be on Washington's target list.
Yeah, and this also is a case where internationally they look at what Washington is doing, which actually is fairly sensible and much more sensible than what it's doing in many other cases, but they look at the hypocrisy of it. Here is North Korea, who has steadily been probably developing a nuclear program, developing weapons of mass destruction for the last several years, is much more of an international threat, both to use that weapon and to export such weapons to terrorist organizations, than, say, Saddam Hussein and the mythical weapons of mass destruction that the Bush administration is now catching heat for having invented over the past year and a half. But the Bush administration is in the midst of cutting a deal with North Korea, saying, "Well, if you don't develop your nukes, then we won't do anything to you. In fact, we'll help you decommission the plants. We'll send you some money to help with food." It's a lesson that if you already pose a threat, if you already have a deterrent force that would make it more difficult for the United States to invade, if you're not a country that is already so poor, a la Afghanistan, or crippled by sanctions, a la Iraq, that the U.S. military can't just waltz in, you know, it's an invitation to other countries to develop their own weapons of mass destruction. And at the same time, it wouldn't be so much except for the glaring inconsistency between Washington's approach to North Korea, which actually from a real politics standpoint makes a lot of sense, particularly because, once again, Washington doesn't have many choices because its military is already spread so thin in so many places. You know, it really does underscore, especially with the arms control structure having been torpedoed, the ABM, et cetera, by the Bush administration in the last couple of years. It's an incentive for other countries to develop these weapons programs. And at the same time, this is not an argument saying, well, the United States military was stretched too thin, therefore we need to be expanding the military. We need to give them even more of a blank check than they have now. We need to recruit that many more soldiers. No. What it is a reminder that it is impossible for any country, even one as wealthy and powerful as the United States, to control the entire world by force of arms. It simply can't be done. The United States is overstretched in two poor countries on the other side of the world as it is. It's a call for a fundamental rethinking of the entire foreign policy approach of the United States, that we need to be acting cooperatively with other countries rather than trying to go it alone.
Yeah, we should be expanding our diplomatic corps dramatically instead of our military one.
Yeah, and studying how to work with other people rather than to conquer them.
All right. Well, with that, we are out of time. Talking once again with Jav Parrish, who is co-editor at Eat the State. And Jav, where do people find Eat the State?
Well, you haven't been able to find it for a couple of weeks because we skipped an issue in July, both for a summer vacation, which we badly needed, and also it saved us a little bit of money. But we will be back on the streets this next week with a new issue. It is a free issue that normally comes out every couple of weeks, and we'll be doing so once again now that we're back on the job. You can find it free around town at bookstores, cafes, places where you find free periodicals, also on the web at www.eatthestate.org. And if you'd like to volunteer, which we could always use, or if you'd like to donate, which we can always use, or have comments, story ideas, feedback, any of that kind of stuff, our voicemail is area code 206-903-9461, and we'd love to have you help us out.